Belgic Confession, Article 37 on the Last Judgment, paragraphs 3. And therefore, the consideration of this judgment is justly terrible and dreadful to the wicked and ungodly, but most desirable and comfortable to the righteous and the elect. Because then their full deliverance shall be perfected, and there they shall receive the fruits of their labour and trouble which they have borne. Their innocence shall be known to all, and they shall see the terrible vengeance which God shall execute on the wicked, who most cruelly persecuted, oppressed, and tormented them in this world, and who shall be convicted by the testimony of their own consciences, and being immortal, shall be tormented in that everlasting fire which is prepared for the devil and his angels. But on the contrary, the faithful and elect shall be crowned with glory and honour, and the Son of God will confess their names before God his Father and his elect angels. All tears shall be wiped from their eyes, and their cause, which is now condemned by many judges and magistrates as heretical and impious, will then be known to be the cause of the Son of God. And for a gracious reward, the Lord will cause them to possess such a glory as never entered into the heart of man to conceive. Tonight we begin a new topic in our study of eschatology, or the last times, the Great Tribulation. And with the Great Tribulation, you could say that the two streams of our previous classes converge. There's a confluence. I'll explain what I mean. Our previous classes began with a huge section on eschatology and time. That's one stream. We looked at the Bible's own time periods, the two ages, the 1,000 years, the 1,260 days, and the last days. Then we looked at two controversial prophetic passages, Daniel 9 on the 70 weeks, and we saw that Daniel 9, 70 weeks deal with the past, not the future. Daniel's 70 weeks cover the end of the Old Testament age, the last several centuries. They deal with Christ's cross, where he made reconciliation for iniquity and brought in everlasting righteousness, and the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. The other controversial passage, which is also appealed to by dispensationalism, were the 9 chapters at the end of the prophet Ezekiel, Ezekiel chapters 40 through 48, that deal with the new temple and so forth. And we saw that those passages do indeed deal with future, future to us, but not future in a literal millennium of 1,000 years before the end of the age, but future in the new heavens and the new earth. And that especially is the interpretation and usage of Ezekiel 40 through 48 in Revelation 21 and 22, which deal with the new heavens and the new earth. So the time periods, 4 of them, the two controversial passages, Daniel 9 and Ezekiel 40 through 48, and the big question is, what periods are they dealing with? And then we also had classes on the nearness of Christ's coming. I hope this is refreshing you and you're remembering this as I introduce these topics, at least those of you who were here back then. The nearness of Christ's coming is not as the foolish, ungodly liberals design or claim. Oh, Jesus and the disciples got all mixed up. They thought Christ was going to come back in a few years. No, the Bible itself tells us explicitly and repeatedly, Jesus does it in Matthew 24 and 25, for instance, that there appears to be a delay, that the Son goes off into a far country, that, this is Peter's explanation in 2 Peter 3, verse 8, with God, 1,000 years are as a day, and a day is as 1,000 years, and all the elect have to be gathered in, and that certain things must come first, as Paul himself tells us in 2 Thessalonians 2, the day of Christ will not come except there come the apostasy, and the man of sin be revealed. So don't get all bent out of shape. That's the first stream. The second stream that converges in the Great Tribulation, that of the signs of Christ's coming and the end of the world. We considered these signs collectively. We looked at them as a group and said, what are the characteristics of these signs? How do they function as signs or pointers? We said, are these signs somehow or other mentioned also in a different way in the Old Testament as well as the New? How do the signs in the Bible compare with the idea of signs of the end of the world in Judaism and Islam? Then we move to a consideration of the signs individually. The three astronomical signs, the signs that involve the sun, moon, and stars. Then there's another triad, pestilences, famines, and earthquakes, listed as such in Matthew 24, and three other ones that we treated, wars, along with the rumors of wars, false Christs, and persecution. And most recently, we focused in much more detail on two of the signs. The sign of global preaching, the positive one, we had eight classes on that, and then the negative one, the sign of apostasy, noting that apostasy is not only like leaven, and an individual is like gangrene that spreads through him or a church and destroys, but it is also a sycophant, that apostasy always feeds off the truth that was taught and brings it down and destroys it. I've been saying that these two streams converge in the Great Tribulation. Like the convergence at Khartoum of the Blue Nile and the White Nile. They just meet there. And the Great Tribulation is the meeting place or convergence of the material of our classes on eschatology and time, because the Great Tribulation occurs in a period. And it's the meeting place of this time period in this Great Tribulation and of the signs, because the signs, at least some of them, are intensified in the Great Tribulation. The convergence of two streams, the time periods, all focuses now on this little period of the Great Tribulation, and all the signs, that's not quite right, some of the signs are intensified within that period. So the Great Tribulation is an intensification of the signs in a short period of time immediately prior to the Lord's second coming. And by the way, this way of introducing the Great Tribulation is also helpful in another way, because it allows us briefly to review what we've covered so far in our eschatology classes on Belgic Confession 37. And we've covered a lot of material. Our first class on Belgic Confession 37 was, and I know this because I looked it up, on the 4th of November 2020. So we've been at it for over 3 years and 3 months. It's almost half the period of the dispensationalist Great Tribulation all in itself. And this is also useful, this brief review, because our materials on the Great Tribulation in this class and subsequent classes is going to build on what we've already covered in the sign, in the time periods and the signs, so that I'm not going to be reinventing the wheel and going back over everything in these classes, though a certain amount of that will be inevitable, no doubt. Is everyone with us so far? Let's begin with names. That's a helpful way to begin in general. Names. So the names, most obviously, the names for our present subject, first of all, we have the Great Tribulation, right? My abbreviation, GT, because it's quite a lot of writing. The Great Tribulation. Who is it who refers to this as the Great Tribulation in the Bible? It's Jesus Christ in the Gospel accounts on the Tuesday of his Passion Week. Let's look at Matthew 24, the passage we read together. Can anyone locate the phrase great tribulation there? 21. For then shall be great tribulation. Verse 29 says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and so forth. So Christ talks about the great tribulation. What about the parallel passage in Mark chapter 13? In Mark 13, do we read here of the great tribulation? Does that phrase occur? Verse 19 in our Bible translation, Mark 13 verse 19 says, in those days shall be affliction. And it's the Greek word thlipsis, which is translated usually in Matthew 24 as tribulation. In those days shall be affliction, that is tribulation. Verse 24 does here translate it tribulation, but in those days after that tribulation, of which the previous verses have been speaking, and you may have recognized that verse 19 and verse 24 in Mark 13 have equivalence in Matthew 24. Now, what about Luke 21, the third passage in the first three Gospels on that Tuesday of Passion Week? Luke 21, its style is a bit different from Matthew 24 and Mark 13, and it does not refer to the Great Tribulation or tribulation as such. It uses slightly different language. Can anyone see a reference to a specific period in Luke 21? It's a hard question, but there's a good number of you here, so somebody I think should spot it.
Well, it talks about the earthquakes and the famines and the pestilences, which are part of it.
Doesn't he? It's definitely talking about the Great Tribulation. But in terms of a label for it, the closest we have is verse 22, the days of vengeance. The days of vengeance. So this is the first name for the Great Tribulation, the Great Tribulation itself. Can you think of another biblical term for this period? Julian?
Jacob's trouble.
Jacob's trouble. We're going to treat that one third. Yep, Jacob's trouble. Any other one? Satan's little season. Satan's little season. SLS. Which biblical author refers to Satan's little season?
John.
Which book? Revelation. What chapter? 20. It's in Revelation chapter 20. So we've Matthew 24 and Revelation chapter 20. So let's turn to Revelation 20. By the way, if you have a Bible with three pieces of string in it, Revelation 20 is going to be one of the chapters you put it in for tonight. Matthew 24 is the other one. I'll tell you the third in a bit. So Revelation 20 verse 3 says that the angel cast him, Satan, into the bottomless pit, shut him up, set a seal upon him, that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years should be fulfilled, and after that he must be loosed a little season. So with Satan's little season, there is literally, in our translation, the LS, little season. We call it Satan's little season because it says he, i.e. Satan, must be loosed a little season. So that's our second reference. We have the Great Tribulation, Satan's little season, and then we come to Jacob's trouble. Can anyone locate the Bible passage that speaks of Jacob's trouble? Jeremiah chapter 30 verse 7. Jeremiah 30 verse 7. Alas, for the day is great, so that none is like it. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it. Now, which group especially says that this is a reference to the Great Tribulation? Which eschatological school?
Dispensationalists.
Dispensationalists. Now, do we believe this is a reference to the great Tribulation? Everybody's thinking hard.
I think so, because we are.
Julian thinks so. Because
we are
sort of Jacob's descendants in a spiritual sense.
Okay, we're Jacob's descendants in a spiritual sense. But when we're dealing with the dispensationalists, their Jacob is not as our Jacob. So they would when they say Jacob, they go, although I was going to say they go literalist, but of course actually they can't, because Jacob was literally one man. Okay, well, I think they could stretch it to being the nation of the Jews. In Northern Ireland, the group that I've heard most speak about Jacob's trouble is, see if your experience has been the same as mine, the Brethren. When I moved, especially in those circles, they mentioned Jacob's trouble quite a lot in their eschatological presentations. I do not believe that Jacob's trouble in Jeremiah 30, verse 7, is a reference to the great tribulation just prior to the return of Christ. Jeremiah 30, verses 4 through 7, is dealing with the fall of the southern kingdom to Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon. It's going to be a terrible time. The men's faces will be turned to paleness and despair. It's a great day. There's none like it. Jacob's trouble. And then the remainder of verse 7 and verse 8 refers to the return from the Babylonian captivity. But one could, so we're going to put a line through that one. One could identify another phrase from the Old Testament which does refer to the Great Tribulation. I'm going to make a case for that. It's in the prophet Daniel. Daniel 12, verse 1, uses the phrase, the time of trouble. Daniel 12, verse 1 says, at that time shall Michael, an archangel, shall Michael stand up, that great prince which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even to that time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book, which is the same thing as the Lamb's Book of Life, a list of the elect. Now here's my proof for this time of trouble as referring to the Great Tribulation. Verse 1 says it's an unparalleled time of trouble, like Matthew 24, but that's not conclusive all by itself. Verse 2 talks about the general resurrection, and then verse 3 talks about eternal glory and the wise and those who evangelize and win others to the truth. They shine as the brightness of the firmament and as the stars forever and ever. So there you have the Great Tribulation, unparalleled suffering, persecution. Then comes the general resurrection, and then eternal glory. And at the end of Daniel chapter 11, previous chapter, we have Antiochus Epiphanes IV, a Greek Seleucid ruler of Syria, who is a type of Antichrist. So then your order in Daniel 11, we'll say more about Daniel 11 later, is Antichrist, great persecution in this time of trouble, then the resurrection of the dead and eternal glory for God's people. So I think this period then does refer to the Great Tribulation. Now let's take time of trouble. Let's take these three names that we do have for this eschatological period and notice the perspective or the focus of these three names. Two of them come from the perspective of the saints, namely the Great Tribulation. This is Great Tribulation for us and the time of trouble. This is trouble for us. By the way, can anyone tell me what is the experience of the ungodly during the period of the Great Tribulation? According to 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 3, see how they can get there first, or if they remember that verse. So I think it's one way of indicating their experience. Because when you say the Great Tribulation, tribulation for whom? The time of trouble for whom? First Thessalonians 5 verse 3 uses the word peace. For when they say peace and safety, then they're just referring to the ungodly, because that's what they're experiencing, or perhaps somebody could argue expecting, but experiencing fits too. Then the Lord comes back and it's agony and destruction for them. So this one, the great tribulation and the time of trouble, that refers to the experience of the saints from our perspective. And then Satan's little season looks at the same period. The dominant figure in Revelation 20's presentation of this period is Satan. And how do you put these two perspectives together? It isn't difficult. In Satan's little season, Satan is dominant and he causes terrible persecution for the saints. Matthew 24, Daniel 11 and 12, all of course within God's sovereign will, including his eternal counsel, predictive prophecy in these passages, and all-encompassing providence. So you could synthesize the names like this. There is a great tribulation in Satan's little season. Or Satan's little season is a time of trouble for the saints. And now we've got these three passages. Daniel 11 and 12, that's Matthew 24 and Revelation 20, and they're the three that we're going to be looking at and paging in the remainder of the class. Two streams have converged. That was our introduction, the time periods and the signs. Then we've looked at the names for this period: Great Tribulation, Time of Trouble, Satan's Little Season. We're now going to consider the duration of the Great Tribulation. Which of those names is the most obvious one to start with, if you're going to deal with the duration?
SLS.
SLS, yes. Satan's Little Season. So, Satan's Little Season. So, the Great Tribulation is a little season, or a little while, you could have translated. So, it's a short period. It's a short period. You could say that's almost a saving grace, and it sort of is, actually. It's a short period in itself. It's called Satan's Little Season, and it's a short period in comparison to the 1,000 years, which, of course, is symbolic. But if you've got 1,000 years, whatever that means, and a little season, that heightens the fact that whatever the 1,000 years refers to, the little season can't be that long. The 1,000 years, as we intimated at the start of the class, has been treated before in our studies of Belgic Confession 37. The 1,000 years is the period between Christ's first and second coming. 10 times 10 times 10, a perfect number. In a symbolic book, symbolic numbers. And the 1,000 years is now 2,000 years or so, and counting. So Satan's little season is like a little sliver or a little while at the end, just prior to the second coming of Christ. Let's move to Matthew 24 for the Great Tribulation. What does Matthew 24 have to say about the duration of the Great Tribulation? What's the closest it comes to it? Yes, verse 22, and let the days be shortened. Verse 22 says, except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. So shortened is used twice in the light of this terrible persecution, not since the beginning of the world, nor never shall be. So it's a brief period, Satan's little season, and God, as it were, has to shorten it. Otherwise, even the elect couldn't cope. That's one of the most terrible ways to talk about how awful it is. Now, there is a question here for you. Which eschatological system is it that claims to know the duration of the Great Tribulation? Because we've said it's a little season. We've said that Jesus talks about the days that were being shortened, otherwise nobody could. But there's one group says that's not enough. We know how long Satan's little season is going to be. We know what God's going to shorten it to. And what is that group? It's the dispensationists. And how long is the Great Tribulation?
7 years.
7 years. Or some might say 7 years with 3.5 years, and then maybe the first 3.5 years not be so bad, and the second 3.5 years be worse. But whatever, they actually do claim to know how long Satan's little season is. Can you identify from Matthew 24 a problem for this? Remember, we've said that Matthew 24 verses 15 through 31 talks about the Great Tribulation, and how it ends with the return of Christ. But there's a verse, actually slightly outside the bit we read, and to which I just referred, that does say something about the time of Christ's second coming. That doesn't fit well with the idea of the Great... Verse 42. Okay, you don't know when the hour is coming. Yes, there's an even better one than that, though. One that's very similar, but even better.
36.
Verse 36. Matthew 24, verse 36. But of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels in heaven, you tempt dad, not even the dispensationalists, but my Father only. And now think it through. If the Great Tribulation lasts 7 years, and it's literally 7 years, now it's not 7 years and 3 days or 7 years minus a week, then the people in the Great Tribulation should know, and anybody with their head switched on at all should know, the day on which Christ comes back. It'll be 7 years to the day when the dispensationalist secret rapture of the church takes place. Now, there are some, I believe, the rapture is at the very start of the 7 years, some in the middle, and some is post. Like, it's very complicated. But I'm just going with the main one. Now, it's good to know what we can and cannot say regarding the duration of the Great Tribulation. It's a short period, a little period. It's going to be shortened, so to speak, in the grace of God towards the elect, enduring unimaginable horrors. But we don't know its definite duration, which is a good thing. Otherwise, we actually would know, or people on the day of the rapture, the dispensationalist rapture within that framework, or thereafter, would be able to work it out. Let's now move to our next heading, the types of the Great Tribulation. And we're going to treat them in chronological order, which means we're going to start with Daniel 12, verse 1's, the time of trouble, in its context. Who are the ones inflicting persecution upon God's people in the last two chapters of Daniel? Usually the answer lies in the text, but this time it actually doesn't. It's Antiochus Epiphanes the fourth, and he was, thinking of the world empires, he was a Greek, an extension of the Greek kingdom of Alexander the Great. And Daniel 12, verse 1, uses a comparative. It talks about this time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. So the persecution here will be worse than all that had happened to God's people up until that point. Now, in Matthew 24, our second passage, the Great Tribulation is the term used here. In Matthew 24, the Great Tribulation is mentioned in connection with, typically, with AD 70, the fall of Jerusalem to the Romans. And then we have Matthew 24, verse 21, for then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. So that's even worse than the persecution under Antiochus Epiphanes the IV. And then Revelation 20, this one's a little bit more remote, but in Revelation, in terms of typology, who is the persecuting power in the book of Revelation? The type. In John's day and slightly thereafter, the Romans. The Romans. But here, the Romans are the persecuting power, not just in Jerusalem, but elsewhere too in the empire. John is, by this stage, he's in the island of Patmos off the southwest coast of Turkey, to use the modern terminology. Now, there's no comparative used in Revelation 20, but it's going to be awful because now Satan himself is loosed. That's the idea of Satan's little season. And he's loosed after being bound for the symbolic 1,000 years, the New Testament period of the New Testament church, from the first to the second coming of Christ. And that must be awful. Now, this idea of types, as well as understanding the biblical framework, is useful for us, because if we're trying to understand the Great Tribulation, and that's our present subject, and this is edifying for us, if we're going to understand the final Great Tribulation in Satan's little season, we're going to have some helps, because we can look at, read about, the Greek persecution in the 2nd century BC. Where in the Bible would you go for information about the Greek persecution of the Jews in the 2nd century BC? Daniel, yeah. Daniel 11 and 12, yeah. Yeah. And there's a vision in Daniel with the ram and the great goat. So, yes, who said eight? Mary, that's... Very good. Yes, Daniel 8. And where in the Apocrypha would you go? Now, the Apocrypha is not inspired, but you are allowed to read the Apocrypha, and it can be useful. There's all sorts of books that somebody can read that aren't inspired. In fact, the vast majority of books that people read, even Christians, are not inspired. There is some value in the Apocrypha. We don't take doctrine from it. The Belgian Confession of Faith even says that it's useful to read, but not as inspired literature. Where do you go in the Apocrypha to find out more about Antiochus Epiphanes?
First and Second Maccabees.
First and Second Maccabees, very good. So, then we've got the Roman persecution of AD 70, a second type of the Great Tribulation. Where in the Old Testament would you go to learn somewhat of that? Daniel chapter 7, the fourth beast. Though it's also, it's Rome, and it's also a picture of the end. And you could say Daniel chapter 2, the iron and clay. And then where would you go in the New Testament to read about the Roman persecution of believers, of the Jews in AD 70? Matthew 24 and the parallel passages. And where would you go in extra-biblical material? Looking for an ancient writer here.
Josephus.
And then Roman persecution, sort of from the 1st century on to the 4th century. Where would you go in the New Testament for that? The book of Revelation. Yeah. And where would you go to find out about Roman persecution in the early centuries of the Christian church? General church history. You could go to Eusebius, for instance, and others. You could even go to Fox's Book of Martyrs. He's quite a bit later, but he deals with some of that too. Is everyone with us so far? The names of the Great Tribulation, the duration, how long is it going to last, and the types, they're all telling us something about it. Now we move into a bigger subject, which will require more work for us all, and which will get us working with the three main passages tonight. The content of the Great Tribulation in Satan's little season. Now, all we're going to do here pretty much is just list the topics, the main ideas that crop up in the three passages in biblical order. We're not going to develop any of them. That'll be future classes. So let's start, as I said, with the first of these chronologically, in terms of the writing. Daniel 11, the last third especially, and into the start of Daniel 12. What is the content of the Great Tribulation or the time of trouble? What are the main elements in here? Sort of one word or two word or three word summaries of them. The sorts of things we've been dealing with as topics in the last several dozen classes. Persecution, yes. Persecution, if you had to put a verse by that, chapter 12, verse 1 would be a good one. So, persecution's mentioned there. What else?
Antichrist.
Especially from Daniel 11, verse 36 and following, but elsewhere too. So you got the Great Tribulation in Daniel 11 to 12 is a period of persecution. It's a period of Antichrist. What else is the content? Power of Antichrist. Yes, so we'll put that one on Antichrist. He's mighty.
Deception.
Deception. Deception's a good one. What verses are you thinking of there, Colin? Verse 32 would suit for deception. And also in verse 32, what's the theological word that describes what's happening in verse 32? It's not in the verse, but what's the first half of verse 32? Apostasy.
Yeah.
It's apostasy. And then verse 31 of Daniel 11.
Abomination.
The abomination of desolation. So Daniel 11 and 12, in terms of what happens in this period, there's persecution, there's Antichrist, there's the abomination of desolation, there's apostasy, there's deception, and then comes chapter 12, verse 2, the general resurrection. 12, verse 3, the eternal state of bliss for believers. Persecution, Antichrist, abomination of desolation, deception and apostasy. Right, Matthew 24, verses 15 through 31, the passage we read. We're moving from the time of trouble to the Great Tribulation, which are the same thing. But what does Jesus say about the features of the Great Tribulation? What are the things that fall under this heading and occur in this period? Deception again, verse
24. The abomination of desolation.
The abomination of desolation, verse 15. So Daniel mentioned that. And of course, we're not surprised that the same thing is in the same period in two different writers, is what you'd expect. There's a certain amount of overlap. What else?
Sorrows.
Yes, sorrows are definitely in there. It's not the way they're typically classed theologically or eschatologically, but yeah, sorrows. Yeah, it's true.
False Christ.
False Christs, yes, in verse 24. And false prophets.
People having to flee.
Okay, people having to flee. Flight. And that's a really interesting one, because the treatment of flight in verses 16 through 20 is the longest eschatological treatment of flight in the Bible, and it's a significant feature of the Great Tribulation. There's times where Jesus told the disciples, they persecuted you in one city, flee to another one. But this is the eschatological treatment of flight, and Lord willing, we'll come back to this in a later class. So we've got persecution, abomination of desolation, flight, a new and distinctive feature, false Christs, false prophets, something else in verse 24.
Signs and wonders. Deceiving signs and wonders.
Yes, great miracles, mighty miracles. And when the New Testament talks about miracles in the post-apostolic age, they're always in connection with the false church and apostasy. Revelation 13, Revelation 16, Revelation 19, Matthew 24, verse 24, and parallel passages, and 2 Thessalonians 2. And then at the very end, verse 29 mentions signs in the sun, moon, and stars. And we looked at that, and we looked at the signs a while back. Then verse 30 comes the second coming itself. Then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. And I take that genitive to be a genitive of contents. The sign, that is the Son of Man himself. And then the angels go to gather all people together for the judgment. Verse 31. Now, this is a question that's very useful, I think, helpful. I found it helpful when it first dawned upon me. What is not found in the Great Tribulation in Matthew 24, verses 15 through 31, that when you think about it, you would have thought would have been there, and then you realize it's not there, and you realize, oh, I wonder why it's not there, and then you realize, oh, I know why it's not there. What am I referring to?
Peace.
Peace? No. Nope. You could make a case for that, but I think there's something even more prominent that you think, oh, it's there, it should be there, it's missing. And then when you realize it's missing, you think, that's a good job it's missing. Otherwise, it would have been a mistake, as it were.
24.
Yes, specifically not in Matthew 24.
The Antichrist.
The Antichrist. But here you've got a passage on the Great Tribulation in great depth, verses 15 through 31. And it's there in Daniel, in the Old Testament. Here Jesus is speaking about it, and he doesn't mention it. You think, well, why do you not mention it? But there's a good reason why he doesn't mention it. Mary?
But isn't the abomination of desolation and that stand in the holy place, isn't that a reference to Antichrist?
Oh, now there's a good question. Is the abomination of desolation the same thing as Antichrist? No. They're related, but they are different. So why is Antichrist not mentioned here?
Jesus seems to move between AD 70 and what's going to happen to the Jews and the Great Tribulation in the one chapter.
That's true. You're getting very warm. Keep going.
So the Antichrist is relevant to us, but not to them.
Not to them. There was no individual Antichrist prior to AD 70. There were false prophets. There were false Christs. Josephus mentions such things too. But there wasn't one guy who excelled and stood out above the crowd as the Antichrist. There wasn't one person in that period of wickedness like Antiochus Epiphanes the IV. So that's the reason. But Antichrist, of course, he is in Daniel's time of trouble, as we said, Antiochus Epiphanes the IV in Daniel 11, therefore, because of chapter 12, he's part of that consideration. And he's there in other scriptures like 2 Thessalonians 2, the man of sin and son of perdition, and the beast in the book of Revelation. Let's move then to our third passage, Revelation 20. Again, it's looking at the same period, time of trouble, great tribulation. Now here in Revelation 20, it's Satan's little season. So what are the features of Satan's little season in Revelation 20? Some things mentioned before, other things not.
Well, deceiving the nations is a worldwide thing.
Okay, deception, as in the other two passages, there's deception mentioned in verses 3 and 8. But then verse 8, now it's worldwide. Worldwide persecution of the people of God. Not just Jews in the Holy Land, Daniel 11, 12, or Jews in and around Jerusalem especially, Matthew 24, but now it's worldwide.
Was it Gog and Magog?
Gog and Magog, yes. That wasn't mentioned in Daniel 11 or 12 or Matthew 24. Gog and Magog occurs in which two Old Testament chapters? There is a reference to Gog, to Magog in Genesis in the genealogy, but Gog and Magog is a fearful enemy. Occurs in Ezekiel 38 and 39. We had some classes on that probably about 2.5 years ago on the last days, because the last days is mentioned in connection with that. And then we had one eye on Revelation 20. So we've got deception, we've got persecution, and then worldwide, and we've got Gog and Magog, and then Satan. It's in the name. Satan's little season. Satan wasn't mentioned as such in Daniel 11, 12, or Matthew 24. It's just you can't mention everything in every passage. And then, at the end of Satan's little season, we have fire coming down from heaven, verse 9, and eternal hell for Satan, the dragon, and other parties. So let's put the key elements. Sorry, Hilary.
To gather them together to battle, is that a reference towards Armageddon at the top?
There we are. There's another key issue that's been brought up. What do we do with Armageddon? What is the nature of this surrounding of the saints in Revelation 20, verse 19? If you take it literally, literalistically, you have Gog and Magog from the four corners of the earth. The nations in the four corners, so you have the whole world mobilized. And then verse 9, they go up on the breadth of the earth and they surround the camp of the saints about, so it's a camp, think like pitching tents, and the beloved city. Now you can't tents, the camp. Now you've got walled city. How do you do both? Well, these are phrases that the camp of the saints, that's like Israel in the Old Testament, the people of God represented. The beloved city, that's Jerusalem, it's the people of God. It's dealing with worldwide persecution of the saints. But then there's the question, what about Armageddon in Revelation 16, which is a very good question, and which is one we will cover later, which means we won't cover it now. But it's good to bring these things up because they're all connected. So let's put many of the elements together from our three passages in Daniel, Matthew, and Revelation. You've got the Great Tribulation, the worst ever, Daniel and Matthew say. It's global, Revelation says. This persecution comes from Satan, Revelation 20, who is, 2 Thessalonians 2 says, energizing the Antichrist, Daniel 11 and 12, who is working through Gog and Magog, Revelation 20. There are great miracles and awful apostasy, awful deception going on, and it's so great that if it were possible, even the elect would be deceived. There's the abomination of desolation and apostasy, so it is absolutely awful. The worst ever persecution, worse than what happened in the 2nd century BC with the Greeks and Daniel, worse than AD 70, Matthew 24, and worse than the worst under the Roman Empire, the book of Revelation. Now, I hope that you didn't want good. There is good news, but this, we have to say the bad news. If your topic is the Great Tribulation, there isn't any way. There are other things we can add, and we're going to bring them out, but you can't dice and slice the Great Tribulation so that it's a positive and a wonderful thing to look forward to. But this is important, though. A wonderful thing to look forward to, I should add, in itself. Because it is so awful, the Great Tribulation, various eschatological systems do something with it. What do they do with it? Well, I'm looking for a system and what it does with it.
Well, the post-mills put it in the past.
The Christian Reconstructionists, especially the post-mills, they put it in the past. And what's the verb for that? They preterize it. Kind of like, what do I do in my garden with weeds? I spray it with weed killer. You know, that's just what you do around the edges and the flower beds. Well, the shrub bush, that's just what you deal with, right? Well, putting it sort of bluntly, this is what post-millennial reconstructionism does. It systematically goes after them and preterizes it. And in fact, there's the classic example with Revelation 20 itself, that Martin Selbride said that the post-millennial reconstructionists weren't optimistic enough. They were too filled with pessimism because they allowed Revelation 20 not to be preterized. They said the whole world's going to be Christianized, and then just at the very end there's going to be awful persecution and apostasy. And Selbride said, this is no good. Who would have thought that Rush Dooney and Gary North and all these guys would have been such pessimists? We need to preterize it too. So he came along with a weed killer, as it were, and just obliterated that passage too. Yeah. So Matthew 24, that's AD 70 exclusively. It's not a type of, or picture of the end. That's just it exhaustively. It's completely finished. It is as much in the past as the Peloponnesian War or World War II. It's back there. It's history book, and only history book. So that's what the post-millennialists do, especially the most explicit ones, the Christian Reconstructionists. Is there another group that does something, Joe?
Yeah, the Dispensationalists.
The Dispensationalists. The Dispensationalists. And this is where a particular doctrine, a distinctive doctrine of theirs comes in, the
rapture.
Secret rapture, which comes just before the Great Tribulation, which is literal 7 years. So the church is in the air, and everything happens down there, and we've escaped. The raptured out of it. Yeah. Notice a couple of common features of the postmillennial reconstructionists and the dispensationalists. They both practice, with regard to the Great Tribulation, avoidance. Avoidance. By hook or by crook. The methods are very different, but we have avoided it. Phew. I mean, I hope the awfulness of it, when we went through this, we did it fairly quickly. We did it fairly analytically. We went through the various stages of it. But emotionally, you hear this and you think, boy. So what is the second common feature of the postmillennial reconstructionists and the dispensationalists regarding the Great Tribulation? We said that they're marked, both of them, number one, by avoidance. You either put it in the past or you put it in the future, way into the future, a future that's not for the church. The second common feature of both the Reconstructionists and the Dispensationists is that they make the Great Tribulation only for the Jews. The Reconstructionists, in putting the Great Tribulation exhaustively and exclusively in the past, in AD 70, that's for the Jews who are in and around Jerusalem. And the Dispensationalists, with their Great Tribulation in the future coming after the rapture of the church, have the Jews going through the Great Tribulation. Now, it is strange that the Dispensationalists charge people who don't hold their peculiar brand of eschatology, often they charge them as being anti-Semitic, which is a foolish charge. But their view actually has the Jews and not the church going through the Great Tribulation, and there's an apparent, if not an actual, inconsistency there. Now, remember a text we mentioned earlier in this class. A text in the Old Testament that gives a name for the Great Tribulation according to dispensationalism. Do you recall what that text is? Jeremiah 30 verse 7, the one that refers to Jacob's trouble. Let's look more closely at that verse. Let's turn to it now. Jeremiah 30 verse 7, "Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it." Now, there are two things in that verse which show why it's such a key element for dispensationalism in this issue, and why especially groups like the Brethren mention it. What are the two things in the text? The time of Jacob's trouble. It's trouble for the Jews. That's one of the things. Because Jacob, in Old Testament prophecy, always only means the Jews. It never means the people of God who are like Jacob. What's the other thing?
He shall be saved out of it.
He shall be saved out of it. Oh, what a text. What a text that tells you it's the Jews are there, but he shall be saved out of it. Then the other question is, but he shall be saved out of it. Surely the he's Jacob. Don't worry about that. And then what about the context? It's talking about the fall of Jerusalem and Nebuchadnezzar. Don't worry about that. Take it literally. And then you get eschatology at the end of the world. No, he's talking about the fall of Jerusalem, Jeremiah is, and how the Jews are going to come back from the Babylonian captivity. And yet this is all sucked off into the eschatology, and it's about Jacob, and it's the Jews going through the tribulation, and it's about people being saved out of it through the rapture, and you're heckin', you hold on a minute, my head is spinning here. And this is literalism. So we've looked at the responses of various eschatological groups, the Reconstructionists, Great Tribulation in the past. Whew. Dispensationists, it's in the future, yes, but it's not for us, we're going to be raptured. Whew. What is the Reformed and amillennial approach to this passage? What do we do with it? Well, generally, we seek to deal with Scripture, including passages which to us, that is to our flesh, are very unpleasant. You've got to deal with. There are a whole lot of other unpleasant things in the Bible. You have to deal with them too. And you have to deal with them, and you have to deal with this issue, in the way in which Scripture says. And what does Scripture say in Matthew 24? What is, in terms of verses, one major way of responding to the Great Tribulation that's laid out here in quite some length? Flee. Flee. That is one. But then again, you could see how AD 70 flee would work. You go to Pella, for instance. But when the persecution is global, well, so flee, that's one thing, and that's a lawful thing to do at any time of persecution. In general, the approach is trust. It's Satan's little season. It won't last forever, although it must be awful. It's going to be shortened because of God's care for the elect, because he realized that even the elect, even with irresistible grace, and as it's shortened, as it were, that we wouldn't be able to hold out. And then we have Luke 21, verse 28. This is a sort of a very specific application of the general call to look for the coming of Christ, hasten his return and so forth. But here in the Great Tribulation, we have this word, Luke 21, 28. And when these things begin to come to pass, then look up and lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. And it's interesting what it doesn't say. When these things begin to come to pass, then look down. Just get the head down and just depress yourself into the ground. Just lie down. No, look up and lift up your head, for your redemption draweth nigh. It's getting really, really close. And keep believing the truth of Christ's second coming and its really obvious nearness. And press on and seek for God's grace. Julian?
I was going to say that reminds me of Stephen. Stephen's being stoned to death, looking up, saw Christ.
Very good. Stephen looked up when he was being stoned to death at the end of Acts 7. And this is also, and with this we'll end, this is also the approach of Belgic Confession, Article 37. The two paragraphs that we read. The paragraph 3 is the negative. There's a justly terrible and dreadful judgment coming on the wicked and ungodly. And then it says that our full deliverance will be perfected in spite of all the labour and trouble which they bore. We're going to receive the fruits of that labour. The terrible vengeance of God is going to be executed on the wicked, who most cruelly persecuted, oppressed and tormented us in this world, especially during the days of the Great Tribulation. And there's going to be conviction and of guilt and everlasting fire. That's the destruction of the wicked. Think about that. God will come and vindicate me. He will punish the wicked. They will not get away with it. Christ is coming back to judge them. And then the fourth paragraph, the positive, think about these things, that the return of Christ will mean that the faithful and elect will be crowned with glory and honour. The Son of God's going to confess our names before God as Father and the elect angels. Tears wiped from eyes. A cause now condemned by many judges and magistrates as heretical and impious will be known to be the Son of God. A gracious reward such as never entered into the heart of man to conceive. Not avoidance, not pushing it off on the Jews, but just solid biblical doctrine about rewards and punishments with the glorious coming of Jesus Christ to make all things new.